Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and begin. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The time is 2:03 p.m. The date is June 17, 2009. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State here on behalf of Secretary of State Bernie Buescher. To my left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. We do not have a representative from the Attorney General's office today. The one set of items we have motions for rehearing on three initiatives for which the Attorney General's office has recused themselves. So we'll just have two members of the title board today. To my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's office. Just general matters of procedure. We do have a sign-up sheet on the table by the door. If anyone wishes to testify, please do sign up. This is a recorded hearing, and it's also broadcast over the Internet. When you testify, please come to the podium and identify who you represent. A decision is reached by a majority of the title board, so in this case it would be 2 out of 2, and we're obviously not concerned with the merits of any proposal. So. With that, then let me turn to our agenda. I believe we could take all three items as a group, even though motions could be made separately on these three items. But we have one motion for rehearing that covers initiatives number 22, 23, and 24. So I'll bring them all forward at this time. And let's first hear from a representative of the motion for rehearing. Mr. Gruskin, I guess if you'd like to come forward and tell us about your motion for rehearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm appearing on behalf of Philip Hayes, registered elector of the state of Colorado. Mr. Hayes resides at 5456 South Ward in Littleton, Colorado, and is registered in Jefferson County. The issues that are raised here are not particularly new. There are some issues that were raised as a matter of the discussion in front of the board that aren't perfectly crystallized. Let me suggest that, first of all, I want to correct a typographical error in my motion. I hope it was acceptable to the board to combine the three together. My law firm is making an extraordinary effort to try and be green, and it seemed not to be particularly warranted to repeat the same claims. Under claim Roman numeral 1A relating to single subject, in the parenthetical, word required should have been the word permitted, because one initiative is number 23 is limited only to those elections that are required under state or federal law, whereas initiatives 22 and 24 applies to elections that are either required or permitted by law. As I discussed at some length and the board agreed with me last time, first argument is that general language in the measure really does take into consideration and applies to, it is our belief, elections that are unrelated to employee representation. I won't belabor the point. It was discussed at length last time. Second argument is that there is a violation of the statute implementing the single subject requirement in that the combined use of fundamental right and guarantee is misleading, in that a fundamental right obviously can be qualified, but a guarantee appears to circumvent the well-accepted case law in that regard. And as a function of that, it appears to pull reference to fundamental right is misleading. I would just point out to the board that guarantee is commonly defined in the dictionary as, quote, something that assures a particular outcome or result. In that event, it is the guarantee language that trumps everything else, and therefore is the key language. The fundamental right language, in fact, is simply an effort to dress up this measure as being more attractive than it might ordinarily be if it was simply discussing the matter as a question of guarantees. Lastly, I would point out to the board that the discussion before it last time by the proponents made very clear that their intent is to create an exception to federal law, that this is to carve out from federal law a set of elections that would be subject to a secret ballot, even though that may not be inherent to federal law. This issue resonates with me. I think this is a separate subject because I know last year the board felt that an initiative that created an exception to another initiative was, in fact, a second subject. And what this does is creates a substantive requirement under law, but it is doing so also in the context of the exception that it will make to federal law. Just as last year the initiative hadn't been passed, this year federal law in question hasn't been passed. But it seems to me there are really two objectives here. One is to institute a state requirement, and the other is to take the state out of compliance with, or the need to comply with, federal law. I would suggest to you that that is a second subject. I'm happy to go over these issues, particularly the ones that I kind of skipped over, A and B, at greater length, but I think the board's familiar with the protesters' position on those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Grusin. Could you elaborate just a little bit more on the last argument and maybe help me better recall what the previous initiative was? This one, it sort of strikes me that carving out an exception under federal law is basically one and the same of what the measure purports to do, is simply make sure that there's a secret ballot for these kinds of designations. But I do want to try to understand a little better to what extent we may arguably be inconsistent with a previous decision. So could you remind me?
Sure. The historical context is this. The measure that ultimately became Amendment 47 was the right to work measure. And Amendment 47, in its formulation before this board, was a measure that would institute the right to work requirement under Colorado law. Subsequently, there was a provision that was proposed that would have allowed for right to work in the state of Colorado, but then would actually define labor organization such that it would create an exception from the other measure if passed. And the measure also was clear that, notwithstanding the number of votes obtained between the two measures, that the second measure would, in essence, trump the first. And it was the feeling of the board that it was one thing to institute a new substantive requirement, but it was another thing to, in essence, create an exception that would allow the second initiative to become effective, notwithstanding the vote of the people. And it seems, because in this instance you've got votes that are being undertaken by two entirely different electorates, if you will. One is the United States Congress, and one is the people of the state of Colorado. Those issues, while they both deal with employee representation elections, if this measure was simply trying to institute the requirement, that would be one thing. The proponents have said that it's their desire to create an exception from federal law. And if that's the case, and if the prior history of the board is meaningful, it seems to me that that, too, ought to be a second subject.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's helpful. I'm not sure I entirely am behind the analogy yet, but I think it's good food for thought. So thank you. Other questions for Mr. Grusin? Mr. Carton.
Mr. Grusin, just a couple of quick questions on page 2 of your motion in paragraph D. Motion says the title set for initiative number 24 incorrectly states that the individuals affected are those, quote, in, end quote, an organization. Again, this is number 24 in the title. how would that be, what's the fix for that?
Well, let me first say that I was going to address the accuracy titles separately.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm happy to do them together. I just have some additional points I'd like to make if the board wants to address them together.
I've jumped ahead. I'm sorry.
Totally fine.
Why don't you go ahead and cover the title issues then as well?
Okay, sure. Let me answer Mr. Carton's question, if I can. The issue is whether or not the reference to individuals in an organization is accurate. And last time, the proponent said, well, this is, you want to refer to individuals rather than employees because individuals takes into account the fact that there will be retirees who are not actually employed anymore, but who are going to be affected and who will be voting. Well, those individuals are no longer in the organization. They're retired. They're outside of the organization. They may have a vote because of the union, but they don't have a vote because they are actually in the organization, unless the organization is meant to be something other than the employer, and that the employment relationship is key, in which case, if that's actually accurate, then the references in all the ballot questions to regarding employee representation are all inaccurate because of the representations that have been made at the last meeting. It's not about employee representation. It's about representation of people who either are or previously have been employed by the entity. Let me, I guess, address then the other clarity
issues. Go ahead.
Issues. Let me address an issue that I think is a predicate issue to all others, which is not addressed in my papers. But the title of each of these measures reads, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the fundamental right to vote by secret ballot regarding employee representation. This issue was, I believe, raised by the chairman last time. But there is no fundamental right to vote under current law. This language implies that there is currently a fundamental right and that it is being expanded upon. Now, I suppose you could fix that by inserting certain language concerning the invention or the creation of a fundamental right. But as it lies right now, this is inherently misleading because voters will think that that right already exists and this is simply amplifying or augmenting it. The argument that we make in the alternative about this guarantee and fundamental right issue is that fundamental rights basically cannot be guaranteed. They aren't guaranteed. As the chairman pointed out in the discussion last time, the whole idea of a fundamental right is that it is tested against a compelling state interest. If the state proves a compelling state interest, it has the right to restrict, limit, regulate, restrict access to that right. The Colorado courts have embraced this analysis. Evans versus Romer, 854 Pacific 2nd, 1270 and 1279, Supreme Court said that the Equal Protection Clause guarantees the fundamental right to participate equally in the political process, and thus any attempt to infringe on that right must be subject to strict scrutiny and can be held constitutionally valid only if supported by a compelling state interest. So that's the status of the law. But there have likewise been cases where that testing goes on and the limitation of a fundamental right is upheld by the courts. McGuire versus Houston, 717 Pacific 2nd, 948, page 954. That was a case in which the fact of political affiliation was deemed to limit the exercise of political rights, and the courts found that the exercise of political rights is fundamental, but that the legislature had the right to restrict access to certain nominating and election processes based upon its need to closely tailor the statutes to the political process. So I would suggest to you that you simply cannot guarantee a fundamental right. The courts have said very clearly you don't guarantee a fundamental right. The board acknowledged as much last time, and to simply reflect the language because it exists in the measure as if it didn't create this construct that is problematic, I think is inaccurate for the voters. My third single subject argument, which, and these three relate to all three of the measures, also relates to the issue of the federal exception. If the intent of this measure is to create an exception to federal law, there ought to be clarity in the title so people know that that's what it's doing. Because even though a measure and a ballot title doesn't have to state its impact on every state or federal statute, nonetheless, the driving force behind this, based on the testimony that's already on the record from the proponents, is to create that exception. That ought to be clear. My other arguments relate only to measure number four, and let me go through them. First of all, there is a disconnect, and this was discussed in front of the legislative staff in the review and comment process, between choosing a representative and actually having an election. And it seems that the title is not necessarily clear as to number 24, that it's the choosing of representatives rather than some other election process that is at issue. Argument C, the definition of political subdivision in this measure is expansive. And I say it's expansive because, not because it has the typical list of city, county, town, et cetera, but at the end, it also includes any other kind of municipal, quasi-municipal, or public corporation organized pursuant to law, or any entity that independently exercises government authority. Now, those two clauses involve an extraordinary reach. And frankly, I don't even know how far that last clause reaches. That's probably not for me to divine, but it's at least for the title to reflect. And I was unable to find any definition in state law that includes all of these categories. And therefore, it seems to me that people ought to know exactly how expansive it is. Argument D is the argument that Mr. Carton raises, and I think, I hope I've explained the point that we were trying to make there. And lastly, the title for number 24 talks about organizations, and specifically what it says is that guarantees the right of individuals in any organization. Well, the reason 24 is distinct is because it sets up as distinct types of categories under paragraphs 2 and 3, all sorts of political subdivisions, as well as organizations that are not political subdivisions. I don't know that organization does justice to a political subdivision, or to the thought of organization, to me, connotes a certain private aspect. And I think that organizations left alone or used in its current format is not accurately or adequately reflective of the intent and expanse of number 24.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gruskin. Questions?
Thank you, members.
Mr. Gessler, on behalf of proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name, for the record, is Scott Gessler, and I'm with law firm Hackstaff Gessler and represent the proponents in this matter. And I will simply sort of take point by point the items in the motion for rehearing. First of all, with respect to argument 1A, the standard for single subject, I mean, it's a well-trod, well-worn standard. But I'll just repeat it to fix the board's attention on that. And what I'll, the definition I'll read for, I just grabbed the most recent case. There's plenty of cases out there. The one in Blake versus King from 2008, last year. And there, you know, Justice Ide basically said that a proposed initiative violates the single subject if it relates to more than one subject and has at least two distinct and separate purposes that are not dependent upon or connected with one another. A proposed initiative that tends to affect or to carry out one general objective or purpose presents a single subject, whereas an initiative that contains subjects that have no necessary or proper connection to one another will be invalidated as containing multiple subjects. And finally, the single subject rule must be liberally construed. So the claim here, it seems, is that the language involving the fundamental right, that the ability to vote here by secret ballot is a fundamental right, is separate and unconnected to the right to vote by secret ballot. And we included the term fundamental right because it's critical to state that the right to vote by secret ballot in these instances for this employee representation and designation authorizations, that right is a fundamental right. And fundamental right is a legal term of art that is used extensively throughout the law. First of all, and I talked about this a little bit before, but I looked up a few cases to provide the board a little bit more background. The term fundamental right is critical to the level of review, for example, for equal protection cases. And basically, about 60 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court sort of came up with the fundamental right analysis in the equal protection context. And what it basically said was that certain rights are fundamental and they trigger strict scrutiny review. So in other words, the government must have, in order to create classifications for fundamental rights, it has to have has to be necessary to a compelling governmental interest. If something is not a fundamental right, the review under the Equal Protection Clause is rational basis review. So what this initiative does is it identifies this right and it labels that right as fundamental. At a minimum, I say, first of all, there's a very clear connection here. A very clear connection. One part of the initiative talks about rights, and one part of the initiative characterizes those rights as fundamental. So there is a necessary connection, and it's a very logical connection. The bottom line is, if this initiative did not have the fundamental right language, there would be arguments out there that this right to vote by secret ballot not a fundamental right. Some would argue it is a fundamental right, and the courts would ultimately step in to make that decision. Here, the very clear intent of the proponents is to make this a fundamental right. There are plenty of cases, I'm happy to at least represent for the board that in my, short little West law search, I simply typed in under Colorado case law the phrase fundamental right, and it came up with about 660 reported opinions. Some of those include, for example, Dempsey versus Romer, that applied equal protection analysis to state employee salary levels. So here we have a case that involves employees in which the court looked at whether or not something granted to employees, state employees, was or was not a fundamental right. And that affected the level of review that the court applied. In that case, the court said it was not a fundamental right and applied a rational basis review. In construing Tabor, Colorado Court of Appeals at least, has said that the attorney fee shifting provision in the Tabor amendment is not a fundamental right. Therefore, it did not enforce it. In that case, it's City of Wheat Ridge versus Cervini, 913 Pacific 2nd, 1110. And the pin site is page 1115. The court has upheld mail ballot elections in part because the right to vote is fundamental, and thus it encouraged legislative efforts to increase the right to vote. In multiple cases, the court has said that the right to initiative in referendum in Colorado is fundamental, and in the seminal case Lunin versus Woodley, which I'm sure at least Mr. Hobbs is familiar with, because that's the case that sort of set out the broadest rationale for the substantial compliance standard for signature review. The court basically said in that case that the right to initiative and referendum is a fundamental right. Because it's a fundamental right, it cannot be impinged upon greatly restricted. I know there's always arguments as to what greatly restricts or not, but in this case, the court said it can't be greatly restricted, and therefore signatures would be reviewed under the substantial compliance standard. That's 882nd Pacific 2nd, 1380, and the pin cites is 1386 to 1388. The courts have prohibited the review of the merits of an initiated measure because the right to initiative, again, is a fundamental right to be liberally construed. And I would also, like Mr. Gruskin, point to Evans versus Romer, where the court fundamentally relied upon a fundamental rights analysis in which it basically looked at a variety of cases and said there was a fundamental right to participate equally in the political process and that any attempt to infringe on an independently identifiable group's ability to exercise their right is subject to strict judicial scrutiny. So essentially what this initiative does is it creates this right to secret ballot. It essentially mandates, through the use of the fundamental right language, that any restrictions upon that right are going to be subject to strict scrutiny review. So I certainly submit to the board here that this is a logical connection between the two sentences, at least, in this initiative. I'd be happy to talk about fundamental right analysis more. I mean, the courts have granted fundamental rights analysis in the voting, as I've noted here, access to criminal justice, right to travel. They've rejected fundamental right analysis with respect to the right to education. And then, of course, the substantive due process area, personal privacy and autonomy, are treated as fundamental rights, too. So the phrase fundamental right is a well-established legal standard. And from that, and we wish to incorporate that well-established legal standard. So that's certainly the response to A, and that response, I think, permeates some of the other responses that I have. With respect to 1B, and please interrupt me if you have any questions.
I'll do that then. Just certainly. While we're on that, and as you recognize, this relates to other things as well. I think I'm more interested in knowing about the I don't really think I have a problem with the sentence that says that this is a fundamental right. I'm trying to understand what the effect is of guaranteeing that right. The language in the next sentence that says that right is guaranteed. What does that add to making it a fundamental right?
The guarantee language, I think, is properly treated as sort of a belt and suspender language. It's a very strong way to state that this fundamental right should receive the highest protections. In part because, you know, there's a well-established line of cases of fundamental rights. Okay? But there have been many instances as well, and I apologize, I don't have the cases before, but this certainly sort of came to the fore under the Rehnquist Court, where the court tried to essentially sort of sidestep the entire fundamental right analysis. They chose not to look at things as a fundamental right or a non-fundamental right. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But in other times they did sort of a balancing act, and they looked at the restrictions and whether or not there was an adequate justification. And in fact, some of the literature out there identifies five levels of Supreme Court review, not merely the rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, and strict scrutiny basis. So the term guarantee is to direct the state here to provide that right with all possible protections.
So would it be fair to say that the purpose is to strengthen the right, while I'm guessing you would nevertheless recognize that no rights are absolute? This is not an absolute, not intended to be an absolute guarantee under all circumstances.
I am unaware of any absolute guarantee of any right in the U.S. Constitution, and of course, or the Colorado Constitution. I mean, the famous is the right to scream fire in a crowded theater house that Oliver Wendell Holmes said. So, and certainly we could have, I guess, even if the proponents had said, this should be an absolute right with no restrictions whatsoever. I mean, first of all, with respect to the title board, I mean, we have the ability to do that. I mean, we could sort of put that in there, and the objector could say, well, you can't do that. And the response to that, I think, properly is, well, we fight that out if and when this initiative passes, and then there's a case of controversy before the court. So I guess the first response to that is, and I do not mean to be disrespectful in saying that I think the question is misplaced, but I think that's a question that's properly reserved for a specific case or controversy to determine the extent of the right under the strict scrutiny analysis or whatever analysis that Supreme Court chooses. With respect to the purpose of the initiative, more germane to the question, I think it can be properly characterized as saying that this right to secret ballot should receive the maximal or maximum protection possible under the Colorado Constitution. And we can ultimately quibble about how far that maximum extends. But again, I think that's properly reserved for a case or controversy before a court of law once this is passed.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Gessler, if I'm hearing you correctly, the measure to the extent that there may be some question about the fundamental right of individuals to vote by secret ballot, this measure recognizes that right, creates that right, restates that right?
I think the answer would be yes to all of the above. This measure establishes the right. You can say perhaps creates it or perhaps recognizes it. A God-given right along the lines of the Declaration of Independence. But yes, I mean this initiative certainly establishes this right, and also establishes that right to that secret ballot for those employee representation designations, authorizations, or elections, when choosing by secret ballot, that right receives maximal protection.
And just
and I think it's a relatively simple concept here. At least I hope it is. Perhaps the application can be complex. But the concept is simple.
And just to follow up on that, and bear with me here, kind of on this fundamental right guarantee, not necessarily cosmic, but trying to get my arms around it. And I understand your argument, and I don't think I'm coming off of my conclusion from previous meetings that I think that sentence, the first sentence of each of the measures relative to the fundamental right of a secret ballot is connected in context to elections involving employee representation. But just as a general kind of constitutional law premise, in my kind of my brief research of fundamental rights and guarantees of those rights and that connection, you have statements in the law, for example, that First Amendment guarantee of freedom of expression guarantees the right to associate or refuse to associate. Sixth and 14th Amendments guarantee the right to trial by jury. The right of cross-examination is a valuable constitutional right guaranteed to all defendants. Fundamental right to trial is guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, et cetera. And so is it too simplistic to say that fundamental rights generally are guaranteed rights?
I think that would be an appropriate statement.
Is that accurate?
I think so. And the reason
and that
why
goes
I say,
to kind of your belt with your suspenders?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I say I think so is obviously I'm not a court of law holding forth on it. But, I mean, The language you repeat, I mean, what we're doing with this initiative is sort of following well-worn expressions of rights and well-worn law. It's not, I don't think it's too simplistic. I mean, this is something that's the use of the term guarantee, the use of the term fundamental right is stuff that's used all the time
and
in constitutional law.
And looking ahead, for example, if the measure was to pass to the extent that legislation was passed that might impinge on that right, it would be subject to the same strict scrutiny?
I think that's appropriate. That's certainly the proponent's intent.
Thanks for that explanation, kind of that clarification.
Certainly. Any other questions, or would you like me to move on to item B?
Okay. No.
So for item B, I'd like to first take up the argument that that there's two subjects because this creates a federal carve-out. And I guess my first response, and this is very, very pointed and adamant in this response, is I don't think that argument is properly before this board. That's an argument that was raised for the first time here at oral argument. I did not see that in the motion to motion for rehearing at all. There's nothing in this motion for rehearing on the single subject protest portion of it, or any of it, that talks about there being two subjects because there's intent to create a carve-out on federal law. I just don't think it's properly before this board.
Well, and I appreciate that. All you know, I think we have to be somewhat liberal here. As you know, a lot of people file motions for rehearing that don't provide any grounds at all. Just and I, whether that's right or wrong, I think I want to. Well,
and the reason I would say I'm somewhat adamant on the point is I've had no opportunity to research this. I've had no opportunity to truly analyze this. I've had no opportunity to prepare for this before the board here. And there is nothing in here that indicates this. And certainly, I would note that that the protester here is represented by very competent counsel. So I do strongly state that that is not properly before the board. One cannot simply say, well, as long as you make a protest, you can add stuff to it at the last moment or even at oral argument. And this is what's happening. That said, I'm happy to turn to the merits unless you
okay.
argue that point even more.
A point noted. Okay. Go ahead.
First of all, right now, this doesn't create a federal carve-out. There is no federal law that this is carving out of. We recognize there may be some law like that in the future. But right now, this creates no carve-out. Secondly, I don't know if it ever will create a carve-out. A carve-out assumes that there is a federal law existing, and this is intended to challenge a portion of it. Like I said, there is no federal law to begin with that we're aware of. And at most, we recognize, that this may create a conflict with a future federal law. It is not our intent to create some carve-out. Not our intent to create a conflict. We recognize a conflict may occur. So that's certainly a point. Secondly, the proponent's unstated intent or an assumed intent, we don't think is a proper basis for determining single subject. We've been very clear on what the purpose of this. This is an affirmative purpose. And to create this new standard by referencing other laws would essentially require or would essentially open the door to saying every time someone passes an amendment or proposes an initiative, they have to identify conflicts that it will have with now, with current or future laws. And I think that's that ultimately becomes an unworkable standard. Each initiative stands on its own. With respect to the initiative that was referred to last year involving the right to work, if I remember correctly, that what that initiative did, the reason why it had a single subject violation, is because on one hand it created or claimed to create certain rights, and on the other hand it created a new mechanism on resolving conflicts of laws with other initiatives. Those were two separate subjects. Those were two separate things. First, here is something that we do substantively. And by the way, if there's anything else, this is how we're going to resolve a conflict. So I think, if I remember correctly, the board. But again, I'm saying if I remember correctly, that's part of the disadvantage here in dealing with a new argument on single subject that's raised at the podium for the first time. So I, again, would return to the fact that I don't think it's properly before the court. If you look at the actual language of item B, course, nothing in here says about a federal carve-out or conflicts with federal law or an intent. It says nothing along those lines. If motions for rehearing were subject to motions to dismiss, I would file a motion to dismiss on this particular item because I think these are entirely irrelevant. Basically, it says the reference to the fundamental right to a secret ballot is misleading and irrelevant. Now, remember, this is a single subject challenge here. It's part of the single subject. The standard for single subject is not whether a reference is misleading and irrelevant. The standard for a single subject, and that's why I repeated it earlier, is whether or not there's a logical and necessary connection between two portions. Furthermore, it says, as such, it violates CRS 1-45-10651D. That doesn't exist, that statute. CRS 1-45-106.5 governs unexpended campaign contributions retained by candidate committee.
I expect that should have been Article 40, 1-40-106.5.
One can surmise. And if I were to surmise that, 1-40-106.5 says, is a restatement that the Colorado Supreme Court has held the constitutional single subject requirement for bills was designed to prevent or inhibit various inappropriate or misleading practices. So what 106.5D does is it reiterates and reaffirms existing Colorado constitutional case law on its face. It says the Colorado Supreme Court has held. It's a characterization of the Colorado Supreme Court. It does not create a new single subject standard that allows someone to characterize an initiative as misleading and then say because it's the language of the initiative is misleading. Not the singles, not the title, we're talking about the language as somehow misleading, that it now violates the single subject requirement. And in fact, the Supreme Court has admonished this title board not to only interpret this to the amount necessary to be able to accurately reflect what it says in a title, not to interpret whether it creates an implication that would mislead someone into misunderstanding current common law. That's what this argument is. Second, it says, and it appears to have been included for purposes of attracting electoral support. Purposes of attracting electoral support, that is not a single subject challenge. It is not the single subject standard. I think item B in its entirety is irrelevant. I would, however, at least note that, and again, I'll go back to the most recent, to this recent round, and this is in re title, ballot title submission clause number 62. That's 184 P3rd 52nd. And what the court there is it reviewed an initiative that had the phrase just cause in it. It was employee firing for just cause or employee termination. And the court there said, just cause accurately describes an element of the initiative. In addition, the term sets forth a legal standard commonly used in the law. And that's page 61 of that case. But to the extent there is a irritation with the terms fundamental right or guarantee, those accurately describe the initiative, and they're both legal standards commonly used in the law. I've given you some of the case law that talks about fundamental rights. Mr. Hartman was kind enough to point out the frequent use of the term guarantee. There is a U.S. constitutional amendments. Those are commonly used terms, and the initiative commonly uses those. I would object to characterizing this objection that's used within the single subject. I'd resist characterizing that as a title objection because it's not that way. But so I at least point that out for this court's consideration. In part, the reason I point that out is because if you look at item 2A, we're now in the title. Essentially, the argument here is that, the argument is that this whole ballot title is cocked up. Because it says it's guaranteeing a fundamental right, but you really can't guarantee a fundamental right if you look at all this case law. So it's internally inconsistent, and therefore the title is also somehow misleading. Well, again, that's not the standard. The title accurately reflects what this initiative does. That is the proper standard. Term fundamental right, again, is a legal term of art, and it's a commonly accepted standard. Item B, I think that item B misunderstands or perhaps takes a very cramped reading, a wooden and cramped reading. I love using that term, a wooden reading of the initiative. Elections, designations, or authorizations are all manners in which one chooses an employee representative. Those are all choices one makes. I think there's no failure to inform of any distinct rights. Item C, the title where it says the title fails to inform voters of the atypical and indistinct breadth of the definition of political subdivision. As the board knows, it need only describe the central features of an initiative, not go all through all the full definitions or definition that's included. But I'd also say that item C rests upon an incorrect premise. It says that it's misleading to indicate the atypical and indistinct. Well, that, of course, rests on the premise that there is a typical and distinct definition of political subdivision. So I spent some time looking at the definitions of political subdivision that currently exist in statute. And I'll read a few of them. One is political subdivision of the state includes but is not limited to, so that's indistinct, obviously, any county, city, city and county, town, home rule city, home rule county, home rule city and county, school district, special district, local improvement district, special improvement district, or service district. That's one definition. Another is political subdivision means a municipality, city, county, city and county, town, or school district in the state. So that's a narrower definition. Another definition says political subdivision includes, so again we have the broader language, an instrumentality of the state or of one or more of its political subdivisions, but only if such instrumentality is a juristic entity which is legally separate and distinct from the state or subdivision, and only if its employees are not, by virtue of their relations to such juristic entity, employees of the state or subdivision. It goes on to say political subdivision does not include a school district. Well, that's a direct contradiction with other definitions of political subdivision. A political subdivision means any district, special district, improvement district, authority, council of governments, government entity formed by an intergovernmental agreement, or any kind of municipal, quasi-municipal, or public corporation organized pursuant to law. So that's very similar to the language, some of the language used in this. And then finally, I'd say political subdivision, this is the final definition, means and includes every county, city and county, city, town, school district, special district, public highway authority, regional transportation authority, and housing authority within the state. However, that definition has been interpreted by Colorado courts, by the Colorado Court of Appeals, to include the Compensation Insurance Authority, because it exercised governmental powers in that case law. So there is no typical definition of political subdivision. And I would certainly challenge anyone to give that to me. Probably been willing to include that, but in the definition. But right now, political subdivision builds upon current definitions of political subdivision to include what has been included in the past, including quasi-governmental and organizations exercising governmental authority. So, again, the first argument is the title really doesn't need to go into all this stuff. The second argument is item B is simply incorrect because there is no typical and distinct definition of political subdivision. So it would be erroneous, absolutely erroneous, for a title to say that this is atypical and indistinct. Item D, with respect to the individuals are affected, that the individuals affected are those in an organization. We're willing to certainly discuss this and make any changes. I don't know what the protesters think is appropriate language. If they're saying something is misleading, I'm assuming they've got an idea in their mind what is not misleading. But I can certainly provide one possibility. And that would say, for item 24, guaranteeing the rights of individuals, rather than saying guaranteeing the rights of individuals in any organization, simply say guaranteeing the rights of individuals, including those employed by the state of Colorado and its political subdivision. So But I certainly propose that as a way to remove the in any organization offending language. I'd also note that the protester, that the written protest applies this to initiative number 24. I heard on the podium that this actually applied to all of the initiatives. I looked at the other two initiatives, and unless I made a mistake, I'm happy to be corrected if I did. But I don't think the other initiatives use the term in any organization. So I think this really is only limited to number 20. So anyway, that's a proposal to remove the in any organization. That's something we'd be certainly open to. And with respect to item E, the titles set for initiative number 24 are not limited to organizations. I'm not quite sure what that means. I'm assuming it's related to the in any organization language that we just discussed. I'm assuming that this proposal solves that as well. So we'd certainly be open to that slight modification on D and E.
Thank you, Mr. Gessler. Questions for Mr. Gessler? I might have one or two. Bear with me just a moment. Maybe just to elaborate on something I think I heard you say with respect to number 24, I want to make sure I understand the measure in connection with I think the motion for rehearing argument 2B. The way I'm interpreting the language in subsections 2 and 3 when those sections refer to the right of employees to choose representatives by secret ballot shall include certain things or not include certain things. The way I read that is that there's not a distinct meaning there. That's really referring back to subsection 1 without all of the detail.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct.
Okay. And I to me that's a fair reading because it's the right as if, I don't know what else it would refer to, what right to choose representatives by secret ballot it could be referring to without reference back to subsection 1. So I took that to just be kind of a shorthand reference to the right that's established in subsection 1, but I just wanted to make sure that's what you were saying as well.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Looking at the titles, and we have number 24 displayed on the screen in the room, but one thing that Mr. Gruskin said that kind of resonates with me is the expression of the single subject that says concerning the fundamental right to vote by secret ballot, et cetera. I think it is troublesome, and we face this from time to time with these types of titles where we don't say that we're it's not concerning the creation, you know, it is potentially confusing. I think I wonder about simply taking out the word fundamental there and reinserting it a little bit later. So it would be concerning the right to vote by secret ballot, et cetera, and in connection therewith, guaranteeing the fundamental right of individuals, et cetera. It doesn't entirely remove the objection that Mr. Gruskin raised, but at least it avoids any implication that there is already a fundamental right to vote by secret ballot.
Well, I would, I guess I would disagree with that in the sense that to follow that line of reasoning, there is apparently some implication that already there is a right to vote by secret ballot regarding employee representation. Initiatives, by their nature, create new things. You don't pass an initiative, simply state what already exists, not that I'm aware of. And to say, well, this creates the implication that there's already a fundamental right. Well, that same line of reasoning says, well, this creates the implication that there's already a right to vote by secret ballot regarding employee representation. I don't think there is any implication that it already exists. What this initiative is about. Yeah, this initiative is about the fundamental right. It's not a non-fundamental right. We've been spend a lot of hot air saying it's a fundamental right. Reasons why we've said that. So,
well, you may be right.
I think it's accurate the way it is.
I mean, but it still seems to me that it's susceptible of an interpretation that there is already a fundamental right, and now it's going to be guaranteed. When we say concerning the fundamental right to vote by secret ballot, and in connection with guaranteeing the right to vote by secret ballot, does strike me that that might be more confusing than saying concerning the right to vote by secret ballot and in connection with guaranteeing the fundamental right. It seems like that's what the measure does.
May I just take a moment to confer with my client
okay,
to see if we're going to vigorously contest that proposal or not.
Okay. And then that'll give me a chance to see if I have any other questions anyway. So
Perhaps I may not want to leave them. No.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Gessler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hobbs. No, we don't have an objection to that.
Okay.
I would say, at least for the record, if I may,
sure.
That we certainly don't think that change is necessary, but and that it's accurate and proper the way it is. There are no improper implications. So, at least for the record, I want to say that, but we're not going to have an objection.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll come back with it. I mean, I do want to hear from Mr. Gruskin on a number of things that you've discussed. I don't think I do have any other questions, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Before I turn to Mr. Gruskin to see if he has anything to add, is there anybody else present who wishes to testify? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Gruskin, would you like to address any of the arguments raised by Mr. Gessler?
Yes, I would. I think the whole discussion of fundamental rights and guarantees has probably been fairly well exhausted. But the fact of the matter is that the proponents have now told you they don't intend it to be a guarantee. They intend the strict scrutiny standard to apply, to be balanced against a compelling state interest. They do not intend the word guarantee to be used. Now, Mr. Cardin quotes a variety of justices using the word guarantee. I have no doubt that those quotations are accurate. But those weren't in initiatives. And frankly, those didn't carry the burden of trying to influence 51% of the vote. And so there's a different standard here. You have a legal understanding that the guarantee of a fundamental right simply doesn't exist, that this is simply used as a strengthening tool, I think was Mr. Hobbs' reference, and was agreed to by Mr. Gessler. He said there's not going to be a guarantee. So if this isn't a single subject issue, it's got to be an accuracy of the title issue. And I would suggest to you that notwithstanding the fact that I'll come back to those issues in a moment, but it seems to me that there's basically been a concession. The guarantee is not an operative word as it is understood by voters. I mean, we've gone through this now at two separate meetings, probably for 45 minutes to an hour each time. And we've hashed out the niceties of what is and what isn't a fundamental right, how it's treated, et cetera. With all due deference, your job is to figure out how to take this little nugget of a measure, or these three nuggets, and make sure they're adequately and accurately, without prejudice, communicated to voters. And all we've agreed upon, I think the four of us, is that there is no such thing as a guaranteed fundamental right. There are guarantees to access to that right, which is all the justices, I think, were saying there. But there is no absolute. And therefore, the extent that the proponents have conceded that, I think you've got to be willing to figure out whether or not you want to send the measure back to them under the single subject analysis, or give them their due and adjust the title and take the word guarantee out. Now, I am interested by Mr. Gessler's argument in terms of the accuracy, because I think my guess is you've probably heard all you want to hear about the single subject arguments. I'm happy to return to those. But he does talk about whether or not the objectors have any right to say anything other than what's in their papers before you. I'd remind you that the Supreme Court has said this is not an APA process. This is much more akin to a legislative hearing. The idea here is to expound upon issues. And frankly, if Mr. Gessler is right and you make a change in the title, I would never get to object to it because I didn't raise it in my papers. And I don't have the right to file a second motion for rehearing. So there has to be the opportunity for some sort of extemporaneous interchange. The Supreme Court has only said, when it decided to limit the issues it would review, that the issues had to be aired in front of you. And that's happened now. As to the specific accuracy issues, the suggestion that in terms of the federal law, I think Mr. Gessler said that the objector assumed or that the proponent's assumed or unstated intent is not a proper basis for single subject analysis. Well, he's right. It wouldn't be. But the issue about the federal carve-out didn't come up, didn't spring from my brow. That was addressed at length by the proponents last time. Mr. Gessler was explaining to you why number 24 was different than 22 and 23, and how if there is federal legislation, which they anticipate is a real possibility, how there may be certain parts of 24 that are left standing and other parts that are not left standing. I didn't raise this issue. Opponents raised this issue. They used it in explaining and justifying the measure. There's no surprise here, and there's no unstated intent here. They told you clearly what they intend and how they intend to make this apply. As to the right to work decision from last time, as I remember, I don't remember the identities of the two board members that agreed that this was a violation of single subject. I think I know, but I don't want to besmirch anybody's reputation by not being accurate. But I will tell you that what I do remember is that the two members didn't agree why there was a single subject problem. And so it's really difficult to say that this is what happened and this is why. I only know that that was the result. Now, as to, and we're still on the single subject line of thought, obviously I did not mean 1-45-106.51D. I meant Title 40. I suppose if we were in a court of law, Mr. Gessler would have an interesting argument. I wonder whether or not a judge would honor it. But the point is that he knows what the argument that's being made. Why? Because I made the same argument and cited the same statute when he was sitting here 2 weeks ago. So whether he was on notice or not is I guess for him to decide. But I know he was here, and I know he heard me because I know he responded to that very issue. Now, that particular statute, frankly, is part of the single subject statute. I understand it hasn't been litigated before, and its exact meaning hasn't been litigated before. So guess what? It's an issue of first impression for you and potentially for the Supreme Court as to whether or not it creates and establishes for the court a standard that needs to be applied. I believe it does. Mr. Gessler believes it doesn't. And I guess we'll find out at some point if this actually ever goes that far. As far as my reference to attracting political support, the statute and the courts have talked about Christmas tree kinds of measures. that are conglomerated so that they are able to pick up disparate constituencies. And that's what that reference was to. I don't really think that there are a lot of the accuracy issues that need reference, perhaps save two. The issue of under Roman numeral 2B, Mr. Gessler has now clarified that he intends choosing to be a summary for the other three words. And with that clarity, I'm happy to waive that objection. I don't think that it was there originally. I don't think that the legislative staff thought it was all that clear, but it's now at least been on the record, and I'm happy to waive that particular challenge. As to the sufficiency of the under Roman numeral 2C of the definition of political subdivision, proponents make my point. There is no clear, obvious definition of political subdivision, and not a single one was read to you includes that last phrase in number 24's definition, which frankly is as broad and unusual a reference as to what a political subdivision is. Will the ordinary voter think that entities, any entity, which necessarily means a non-governmental entity, that independently exercises governmental authority, is now subject to this? Because if they do, then they will understand, without the title reflecting it, that this isn't a public employee type of measure, that this applies to every entity regardless, and that if the public provisions, if the public employee provisions survive, this aspect is meant to cross over into the private sector application of this measure. And frankly, that's key. This isn't about either or, depending upon what statute the federal government passes. This is about making sure there's an incursion into private employers and imposing these requirements, notwithstanding any other provision. Do people have any idea of the Court of Appeals decision that Mr. Gessler references? Who knows? I don't have that divining rod. But I think that there, as he very accurately points out, there is no clear known definition of political subdivision. But I can guarantee you one thing. If you ask someone on the street what a political subdivision is, I can't imagine that they would come up with this definition. Finally, as to your point, Mr. Hobbs, would it be acceptable to take the word fundamental out of the first line and stick it into the third line? And I think that you still have the issue that it treats a right as existent when I don't think anybody in front of you is maintaining that that is an existing right. It helps, but it frankly doesn't cure the issue because the first line would talk about the right to vote as in summary fashion, and then the third line would talk about guaranteeing the fundamental right, and it would appear to be connected. And if the argument is, well, they already have a right, but they don't have a fundamental right, and you use fundamental on line three after guaranteeing, it would be virtually impossible for someone to read those two references and not link them. Without talking in the statement of the single subject about the creation of a right to vote by secret ballot, you won't accurately tell people what this is doing. And so I would ask you to grant the relief. I appreciate the openness that the board has shown to a number of these arguments, and while I doubt you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Two questions that I can think of. So on your last point, would it help if we struck the reference to fundamental right entirely and just said something like concerning voting by secret ballot regarding employee representation and in connection therewith, so that the single subject would be expressed as voting by secret ballot regarding employee representation? I don't like the ing,
yeah,
but
right, that's what I'm wrestling with. You actually have three gerunds there in about six words. But I hear where you're saying, and I guess what I can say to you is taking fundamental right out of the statement of single subject is helpful.
I mean, one other question. I didn't quite follow. When you were talking about political subdivision, I didn't understand your argument about how the definition of political subdivision, what I thought I heard you saying is that the definition of political subdivision is so broad that it encompasses private organizations. And it seems to me that it's an expansive definition of political subdivision, but it still only applies to entities that exercise governmental authority.
The courts have said, for instance, under the Open Records Act, that a private developer that is operating in the stead of a public entity has Open Records Act reporting requirements. Forest City, and they were acting, you know, in the stead of the city and county of Denver or some other public entity. Stapleton Development Corporation, Mr. Gessler advises. I think that that's an entity, and it independently exercises its governmental authority, I'm pretty sure, and I think it would be covered by this provision, and therefore you will have private entities that are treated as public subdivisions. I think that's the goal of this. That's not the goal of this phrase. I'm not sure what is, given the expanse of the preceding language.
It still seems like that's a long ways from covering any private entity. I mean,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to suggest that it would cover every single private entity. But there will be a host of private entities, as well as public entities, that are covered because of the expanse of this definition.
If they independently exercise governmental authority,
right,
as opposed to as an agent or as an instrumentality or by contract or whatever. I mean, I can see how an authority, for example, would fall under that definition of political subdivision, but I don't know that I find that surprising if you're really trying to cover governmental agencies. I think probably most people think of at least the state authorities that I'm familiar with as being governmental agencies.
Right.
Even though the statutes that create them say that they're not state agencies, it doesn't seem surprising to me for a definition to encompass authorities, for example.
But this isn't just encompassing authorities. This is encompassing private companies that are engaged with contracting with authorities or units of government, and therefore, by extension, have some sort of governmental patina.
And I'm still struggling with that. Under what circumstances do they independently exercise governmental authority? It seemed like those examples are not operating independently of government.
If I knew what this applied to, I wouldn't be asking you to put it in the title. I don't know. I think people ought to be told in the title. I don't know. Maybe Mr. Gessler can give us a clue as to what that meant. He didn't just prior to now, but maybe there is a subset of entities. I just think that is a tricky enough clause that it ought not be concealed from voters. That's all.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks. Anybody else? Mr. Gessler, briefly?
Very briefly.
Okay.
I just want to ensure that there's no argument of assent through silence. I do not feel so we made any concessions earlier with respect to the whole guarantee fundamental rights approach. I won't belabor that point. With respect to removing the fundamental right language, this establishes a right to vote. It's not concerning voting. It's concerning the right to vote. This doesn't govern, you know, the mechanisms of voting. It guarantees the right to vote in secrecy. So I think it would be misleading to pull out both fundamental and right to vote in the clause. Finally, with respect to the political subdivision argument, Stapleton Development Corporation is the case that applied the term political subdivision. It's one of the cases that's applied the term political subdivision in the open rights case, as is, and the one that I had in particular referred to with respect to the Compensation Insurance Authority. That was the Dawson versus State Compensation Insurance Authority, 811 Pacific 2nd 408. I think this is the reason why the Supreme Court's been very clear that you don't have to put full definitions in the titles. Stapleton Development Corporation had, I think it was a 9-factor test to determine whether or not something is a political subdivision and exercises independent governmental authority. So I guess, you know, one could put this entire definition along with the 9-factor Stapleton Redevelopment, I think Stapleton Development Corporation test in the ballot initiative. I don't think that's necessary. I think that, you know, exercising independent governmental authority on governments, political subdivision, you know, accurately characterizes that. I'd also say the man on the street test is not the appropriate one. For better or worse, Colorado courts have said that when voters pass on an initiative, they are assumed to know the existing state of the law and to incorporate it. So based on those assumptions, and the ones that we rely upon all the time, for better or worse, the existing case law extends the term political subdivision to organizations like a state compensation insurance authority and Stapleton Redevelopment Corporation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gessler. Again, anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none, then I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board? Mr. Carton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion and the clarification on the motion by Mr. Gruskin and Mr. Gessler. I just would have to respectfully disagree with the arguments posited by Mr. Gruskin with respect to the single subject issue. I think that most of my conclusions on why I feel as though the measure contains a single subject have been articulated in previous hearings. With regard to argument 1A, the initiative covers elections that are required by law but that are unrelated to employee representation. I would disagree with that, and I think that the all three of the measures, that language needs to be read in context. And I think that rules of statutory and constitutional construction, as well as case law, are supportive of that, as well as the testimony that we've had here. 1B, the reference to a fundamental right to a secret ballot, is misleading and irrelevant. Again, in light of the guarantee language in the measures, again, I just would respectfully disagree with that. I don't think the reference to 140.106.51D, that argument, and I believe I understand the argument, doesn't resonate with me as far as granting the motion on a violation of single subject grounds. I still don't think that those phrases and that discussion necessarily leads to a single subject outcome under 140.106.51D. And so I'm still of the mind that each of the measures contains a single subject. And as far as the title for all three of the measures, I think that the titles for each is written under the standard of 140.106.3B. I think that as written, they correctly and fairly express the true intent and meaning of each measure as written. And so I would, again, disagree respectfully with the arguments posited in 2A and 2B. With respect to 2C, and the discussion of what is a typical political subdivision, I tend to agree with Mr. Gessler and Mr. Gruskin that there isn't really a typical definition of a political subdivision in the statutes. I too did the search, and I think it's within the right of the proponents of the measure, the writers of the measure, to articulate a definition of a political subdivision. And I can't say for certain that that the last clause warrants a further articulation of that definition in the title. And I guess in that regard, I would fall back on some of the discussion here that the title need not spell out every detail of a proposed initiative in order to convey its meaning accurately and fairly. And that's Henry Title regarding Proposed Initiative 1997-98, number 74, 962 P2D 927. And then with regard to D and E, if I can't even remember now who posited the fix to the title language, removing "in any organization." If that particular change addresses D&E, I'd be supportive of that. I'd be supportive of the change to the title language that that moved the word "fundamental" from the statement of single subject to the trailer, but I wouldn't necessarily be supportive of removal of the whole fundamental right, just because of the language of the measure, because I think that it does, as currently written. And I understand the argument about whether or not there is a fundamental right, whether this establishes a fundamental right, whether as written this somehow implies there's a fundamental right that may be misleading or confusing. But I'm not inclined to change it.
I agree with Mr. Carton on the single subject question. It does seem to me that the measure each of these measures is a single subject that concerns voting by secret ballot and employee representation issues. Just to elaborate on a couple of things by way of, I think, essentially agreeing with Mr. Carton, on the definition of political subdivision, I would feel differently if the definition was contained something that would be a surprise to voters, and I don't see that here. I do see what appears to be a definition that is intended to be as broad as possible, while still being consistent with the idea that we're talking about entities that exercise governmental authority. This isn't a situation where there's a definition of animal that includes algae or things like that. I mean, this is or a definition of cats that includes dogs. Rather, I don't think there's a title defect here with respect to simply saying political subdivisions. The discussion about guaranteeing. I also feel like the title does fairly express the measure, the measure itself says that this right is guaranteed, and whether even if the proponents meant that they intended to establish an absolute right, I think we are accurate in the title that the measure guarantees the right of individuals, et cetera. But I think we also know from the testimony the proponents don't intend an absolute right. I think they intend to guarantee that in the constitutional sense, in other words, to maximize the fundamental right, is the way I understand it. But either way, I feel like the title clearly and fairly expresses the measures. There are a couple of things in the titles that I would like to have some discussion about, and maybe if we could, we've got number 24 on the screen, and I think that's the one really to start with, because it'll affect the others as well. Mr. Gessler?
Yes, sir. I would point out, and I guess I'm going to be a little bit, I'd at least like to make my case. Okay. That the title challenges were limited to number 24, and I also would say that, you know, if you look at 1-40-107, it talks about the motion for rehearing, and then it says under subsection 2, if any person presenting an initiative petition for which a motion for rehearing is filed. Any registered elector who filed a motion for rehearing pursuant to subsection 1 of this section, or any other registered elector who appeared before the title board in support of or opposition to a motion for rehearing, is not satisfied with the ruling of the title board upon the motion, then the Secretary of State, and then it goes on to the annex. I mean, so this is geared for a motion for a rehearing. It's not a free-for-all. That was certainly my argument with respect to the federal carve-out argument. The challenges to the title are limited to number 24.
I'm sorry?
I believe they're limited to number 24. They are not, can't challenge one, say number 24 has these problems in the title, and then say, oh, by the way, it applies to everything as well.
Well, isn't it, You know, and I, as I indicated before, I'm reading the motion for rehearing somewhat broadly. It clearly applies to all three. The caption is motion for rehearing on 22, 23, and 24. The Roman numeral 1 says the initiatives violate single subject for various reasons. Number 2, the titles, Roman numeral 2 says the titles set for the initiatives are misleading and inaccurate. And to the extent that the details in the arguments may be lacking or wanting, you know, I just would be troubled because the board has never been that required such precision from proponents who file motions for rehearing.
Well, let me restate that. I think A can fairly be said to be 23 and 24. Perhaps I misspoke there. But certainly items B, C, and E, by their face, say that they're number 24. I mean, it's not a matter of saying that they have to be precise. They've chosen to be precise, and I think words have their plain meaning, and that's what this is based on.
Mr. Gruskin.
This is one of those kind of, I don't know why we're even talking about this kind of issues. In the introductory paragraph to this motion, I define terms. I define titles as applying to all three measures. I define initiatives as being all three measures. I don't know really why we're excited about this because, frankly, the items that have been specified, B, C, D, and E, are specific to number 24. A clearly applies to all three because the introduction talks about the titles. I posited two other arguments that I very clearly said apply to all three. One, that there's no fundamental right to vote now. That's a clarity issue, as to all three. And two, there's an issue as to whether or not this is a federal carve-out. That applies to all three. I was very clear below. Frankly, the initiative by its term applies to all the initiatives except where there is a specific reference to Initiative 24. I'm happy to talk about this, but it's a nice summer day. Let's go outside.
And I tend to agree with you, and I, you know, as a general matter of practice before the title board, on the one hand, I think it's everyone is better served when a motion for rehearing clearly articulates reasons. And I'm not disagreeing with what Mr. Gruskin just said. I'm just saying, as a matter of policy, really, it's better when we have all of the objections on the table and matters are not raised for the first time orally. But even if the motion for rehearing was defective in some sense, I do believe that, you know, the practice has been that we've had motions for rehearing that were one sentence, handwritten, at the conclusion of the initial hearing that said, I object to the initiative on single subject and titles. And I don't think people who file motions for rehearing should be penalized to the extent that they do attempt to articulate reasons for their motion for rehearing. Now, maybe that whole policy ought to be revisited. Maybe I would be more comfortable doing that if we did it by rule or by some way of giving notice to the public, and I don't even know that we have the authority. But in any event, I think it's more that the title board is more quasi-legislative than judicial, and I think that also indicates quite a bit of leeway as well as far as arguments to be made on motions for rehearing. I think we have gone beyond, well beyond motions for rehearing quite frequently. Again, right or wrong, I think that's what we've done. Granted, this argument may be pursued at a higher level, but that's kind of where I am right now on this general topic. So
I'd agree with that.
I would like to, looking at number 24, the title that we set last time, and I think this pretty clearly relates to the motion for rehearing, I think we do need to fix line 3, and Mr. Gessler, I think, pointed that out, that we, to be consistent with the titles for number 22 and 23, I think we ought to strike, well, let's see, it ought to read the right of individuals strike in any organization. Then I think it would probably have to make another change as well, but I think in that respect, then that would make number 24 consistent with 22 and 23 that refers to the right of individuals to vote by secret ballot. The other issue that Mr. Gessler, I think it was Mr. Gessler, pointed out is that when you, in 24, when we go on to say including the state of Colorado, well, then that doesn't quite work because there's no reference back to organization. But I think Mr. Gessler's suggestion was including employees of the state of Colorado and its political subdivisions. So I guess I'd suggest we insert including employees of, right after where Ms. Gomez is inserting that. So I would make that motion, and is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Gruskin.
Just for the record, just so that there's no suggestion to the Supreme Court that this issue wasn't fully and fairly aired, the statements in the hearing 2 weeks ago were that these were not limited to employees. That's part of my motion for rehearing. So I think that if you're going to alter that phrase and limit it to employees, I just want to reserve the right to raise that on appeal because I think it's not.
And I appreciate you bringing that up. I actually, before Mr. Gessler made that suggestion, I think I was actually thinking about addressing that issue in another way, by changing the word individuals in line 3 to employees, notwithstanding that testimony, because the measure pretty consistently refers to employees. And for purposes of the title, I think that's a fair reading of it. There may be, you know, the fine print may be that it's more than current employees, for example. But I think we could say in line 3 the right of employees to vote by secret ballot. But I don't want to fight that battle if we're all, well, if at least we can just simply, in number 24, insert employees one time. So
I just want to reserve the right to raise that.
Understood. So the motion then is in line 3, rephrase that to say guaranteeing the right of individuals, comma, including employees of the state of Colorado and its political subdivisions, comma, et cetera. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. The other question that I recall about the titles was line 1. In the expression of the single subject, whether we should remove any words, basically. I would prefer to just simply say concerning voting by secret ballot. And I think I heard Mr. Carton say he couldn't support that. He could support removing the word fundamental, I think. Is that correct?
That's correct, but I guess would it be appropriate to ask the proponents about that particular change?
Sure. Mr. Gessler?
We would object to removing the right to language.
Mm-hmm.
We don't object to moving the word fundamental. And I believe that the suggestion earlier was to move the word fundamental to the third line right after guaranteeing the.
That's correct.
Insert it between the and right.
So
we don't object to moving fundamental. We do object to the right to vote.
Okay.
Language.
Thanks.
Altering
and just to elaborate, and I won't make that the motion I prefer then, but to elaborate, I think we face this in setting, expressing the single subject. We face this from time to time where we say concerning something, and that something doesn't exist right now. Sometimes we solve that by saying concerning the creation of, the establishment of, the enactment of, or something, but. Here, there's no right. I don't think there's not certainly not a fundamental right, and it is susceptible to, I think, to a reading that people might think this thing already exists. In other words, the right to vote by secret ballot already exists, and then what the measure is doing is guaranteeing that right. That's the change, and to me, it's the simple single subject really is. Voting by secret ballot in these circumstances. So that's sort of the rationale. I think at least it would help to move the word fundamental further later on. So I guess I'll, unless I've now convinced Mr. Carton, then I'm going to move that we rephrase that to say concerning the right to vote by secret ballot regarding employee representation, then move the word fundamental to what's now line 3, right before the word right, so that it would read guaranteeing the fundamental right of individuals cetera.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. So with respect to number 24, I'll make a motion that that the board deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the titles to number 24.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. And for the record, the time is 3:38. Then let's move back to number 22. And consistent with what we did for number 24, I'll move the same change that we strike in line one, strike the word fundamental, and move that in to line three before the word right, so that the expression of the single subject is the same as in number 24.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. And I'll move that the board deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the change has been made to the title to number 22.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. That concludes action on number 22. The time is 3:40. And then moving to number 23, I'll make the same motion that consistent with the changes to the titles in 22 and 24, that we strike the word fundamental in line one, move it to line three to precede the word right.
Second.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. And then that concludes action on number 23. And I think that concludes action on our agenda. The time is 3:40 p.m. and we're adjourned. Thank you.